in my head, I was thinking, is this real or not? And at the moment I thought those thoughts, a metallic diamond-shaped object, like a rhombus, literally just appeared over the skies, over, you know, Maida Vale, central West London. And it pulsed in and out of reality maybe 5 times. I'm asking myself, am I sane? Am I well? Yes, it seems like I am, but you know, there was nowhere to turn. Now there's a lot more people that you can go to. There's a community, and it's you know, it's a very disparate community. There's a lot of infighting and overly aggressive opinions that are being forced one way and the other. This is the issue with the subject. It's very much firmly in the hands of the intelligence community, the military, and as we've seen the most recent legislative bill, in the hands of contractors. And it's sad because nobody, in my view, owns this subject.
Have you ever wondered if your company is maximizing the return of your data investment? Are you collecting the right data required to make informed decisions? Is there more that can be learned from our data? Coeus Institute can answer these questions and help you discover the hidden value within your data sets by utilizing a well-rounded approach to data analysis. Stop leaving value behind and start increasing the return on your data investment. The next generation of data analysis has begun. We are pioneers in pattern discovery. We are Coeus Institute.
Well, thank you for having me, Jay. And I just want to commend the quality of the work you put out. The interviews you've done are extremely interesting. And in fact, that's how I first heard about you, when an Australian ufologist friend, originally from Mauritius, where I'm from now, where I'm based at the moment, told me about this unbeknownst investigative journalist, Ross Coulthart, and told me to check him out. And he forwarded me a link to the exchanges that he had with you over on this channel. And I was just blown away because I was seeing a sort of a depth of conversation that I like to have with my, you know, my peers, my friends, the research, and the fact that it's being taken so seriously. And that was... that was amazing. And I knew I had to get in touch with Ross and with yourself. And it kind of started there. And then Ross introduced me to you and to a number of other researchers in Australia and other, you know, friends of ours that we know pretty well now. That's how it kind of started in terms of how we got to know each other. But as for me, I'm a lawyer. I'm dual qualified in England and in Mauritius. I'm a barrister by trade. But my interest in the subject is really through experience. That's how it kind of jumped out at me. I've always had an interest in the hidden or the unseen. And, you know, I had some interesting experiences growing up, but they were kind of sporadic. It wasn't like it was occurring every day. Like little glitches of strange things that would happen, and then I would just sort of ignore it and carry on, maybe tell one of my school friends about it, and that was that. But it really started the exposure to, you know, the high strangeness, as they say, when I was living in a house in the south of England. I just moved into a home, and it started to experience poltergeist activity, and it was... it was like something out of a film, in that, you know, you're walking out of one room, the kitchen, and then you walk back in again, and then all the cupboards and the drawers are open. Like, this really happened. And you'd be woken up in the night with banging underneath the bedroom, hearing chairs being pulled from underneath the counter in the newly refurbished kitchen at 2 a.m. And it was shocking. And I was just trying to figure out what the hell was going on. And in the end, within some months, I moved to Mauritius after we had our daughter. And it didn't stop. It just kind of morphed from, you know, the kind of poltergeist paranormal stuff into seeing UFOs. And I didn't associate the two at the time. I should probably just jump back a second. The first UFO I ever saw was while I was living in London. So that was before I moved into this house. And that was amazing. I was walking back from a cinema with my girlfriend at the time, from St. John's Wood, which is a nice kind of neighborhood, fairly elevated in central London. And we were walking back towards a place called Maida Vale, where the BBC has a pretty famous kind of radio recording studio. And we were just walking at the sort of crest of this hill. It was, you know, first few months of, I think, 2010. So it was pretty cold, beautiful blue skies, sun was shining, stunning. And, you know, bearing in mind that London is some of the busiest airspace in the world, if not Europe. And at the time, I was starting to research the phenomena UAP. And in my head, I was constantly thinking about it, and I was getting frustrated. And I was, you know, we'd gone to see a film. I don't know if it was sci-fi or not. I don't recall. But in my head, I was thinking, is this real or not? And at the moment I thought those thoughts, a metallic diamond-shaped object, like a rhombus, literally just appeared over the skies, over, you know, Maida Vale, central West London. And it pulsed in and out of reality maybe five times. And, you know, 1 minute it's there, it's reflecting the sunlight, the next it's disappeared. Then it's pulsing back in and it's there, you know, and it repeated itself. So anyway, that happened before I moved into this house, you know, and then we moved to Mauritius. The first time I experienced witnessing a UFO in Mauritius, that was probably, I think it was September 2013. And, you know, I went outside the apartment where we were staying and went to move my car outside to let somebody else come into the street because I was blocking it temporarily. And I'm just looking over towards the sort of west coast, towards a place called Albion, which is Old English for England, bizarrely. And I see this massive elliptical orange-shaped object. It was like a miniature sun that was just sitting in the sky, just there. And honestly, I thought I was just exhausted and hallucinating. So I just went to bed. And then the next morning I woke up, I turned on the radio whilst I'm having my breakfast, and there were just floods of calls coming onto, you know, one of the local radio channels that people had seen what I'd seen. And bizarrely, I think in the days or weeks that followed, there was this mundane explanation that what this elliptical orange sun was, which kind of resembled what was photographed, I think, in Mexico City in 1980 or 1984, I forget. But if you Google it, you'll see it. And it was just explained as rocket re-entry by SpaceX doing a test flight or something like that, which was, you know, ridiculous. So that was the first experience I had in Mauritius. And it's kind of, it hasn't really stopped. It's just evolved. And it's something that you never fully get used to, but you become more at peace with as time goes on. You know, I go for evening walks pretty frequently around where I live, and there's sugarcane fields that surround the area. It's pretty remote. And there's mountains, it's beautiful here. And, you know, you could just be walking out and then you will see, you know, these burning object-like spheres that just show up fairly similar to what I think you've seen, Jay. Often bizarre streaks of light that will just appear like flashes of lightning or sheets of light that have a geometric shape to them that just appear and then disappear. And a whole lot more. And it's just, you know, I could go on and on and on. But, you know, I acknowledge and respect the fact, and I feel privileged to have had these experiences, but it's not something that pushes me in any sense at all towards ideological in terms of this is what it is, this is what I believe it to be, it makes me special. This is not how I see it. And I think there are millions, if not millions upon millions of people that have these experiences, but they don't necessarily talk about it. But I think what's happening at the moment, as we're seeing in the last 3 weeks and 3 days, no less, and three is 33, very esoteric number, it's becoming more acceptable to deal with this. If you're reading about it in, you know, the mainstream media or, you know, respectable alternative media sources and that kind of thing. And it's great because it just gives people permission to acknowledge what is one of the greatest questions that we face. Are we alone? And it doesn't mean necessarily just simply extraterrestrial, as you very well know. I'll give you an example. Today, I went to have lunch with a very dear friend who's a barrister, fellow barrister here in Mauritius. And we're finishing lunch. And a man came over to our table and introduced himself. He was the Mauritian or ambassador for Mauritius to the United States. And he, you know, is friends with or knows my friend. And we just introduced ourselves and we had a chat. And he said, well, I'm actually flying out to Washington in the coming days. Of course, being like yourself, obsessed with the subject of UAP and what's coming out in the media and the US government at the moment, I immediately said to him, are you following developments that are happening in the US, you know, surrounding, you know, congressional hearings? There's now the Intelligence Authorization Act of 24 that's just been put out in a bill format. You've got the Defense Authorization Acts of the last 2 or 3 years. He had no idea. And he was fascinated. He was captivated. And when I finished speaking, he just sort of turned to my friend and we just carried on talking normally. And I just wasn't sure whether he'd processed what we, you know, I discussed and what I'd mentioned. But at the end, and we were leaving the restaurant together, he stopped me and he said, please send me across the legislation and any other, you know, relevant information you have. He said, you know, I know that what you're saying has legitimacy. I just want to know more about it. And he's not the first politician that I've met. I met a UK cabinet minister some months ago. And, you know, he was aware of what was going on in the US. But there was just, you know, with respect, and I do respect him, there was an incredulity. It's almost like even people that are at the helm of nation states and government don't really know how to process it. You know, why should we care? Why, you know, how do I deal with this? And because they're humans, but we're people. And they're just not educated enough. And it's, I think that's partly our role. I mean, we have to transmit to people in a responsible way. And it's a burden. It's a lot of responsibility because, you know, we hear a lot of things. There's tons of information floating around, but we have to kind of adjust like any lawyer would when speaking to anyone. You have to adjust your audience and ask yourself, who am I speaking to? And I think that this government initiative that's happening in the States, the legislation, the technological side, which to me is fascinating, but it's not as interesting as the spiritual dimension that I think this path goes towards. You have to press on these buttons to relate to people, and it's hard because even that is very challenging for most people. Anyway, Jay, cheers. I'm just going to have a cheers.
Yeah, no, thank you. And you know, you're right, and it's laying the groundwork for people that are not accustomed to this. And I think in Britain, it's pretty clear because there's not many people that know about any of this. I mean, I'm pretty confident that I could grab someone off the street and 9 out of 10 of them don't know about the legislation, don't know about the bipartisan process in Congress and the Senate. They're not aware of these things. They've never heard of Chris Mellon or Lou Elizondo or any of these things. So it is definitely still outside of the States, a discussion that most people are not accustomed to being seen taken seriously and having lawyers or politicians or businessmen, you know, talking about this. I was recently very gratefully invited onto a podcast for traders in the financial sector, and it was their first UFO-related interview. And, you know, that's what I was trying to put forward in that, is laying this groundwork of like, look, yes, there is a lot of crazy people and there is a lot of absurd claims and a lot of things that can't be substantiated. But what can be substantiated is enough, I think, to start laying that groundwork of sensibility and having a real professional discourse on this kind of issue. And I think as much as a lot of us are concerned about kind of like a national security narrative or a militaristic narrative around this, there is still a component of necessary discourse in government, which has to take that kind of route. And I think that's what allows people to start opening up about this. And then, as you said, getting into the deeper trench of what this really represents, which is where I'm at, and that's where you're at, the philosophy of this, what does this really mean? And, you know, kind of going back to what you were saying about one of your original sightings, you know, this is the component where I'm like, yeah, what is this? Because you're standing there and you're thinking in your mind, I want to see something. And then it turns up. And it's like, you know, is that just aliens in spacecraft? Or is that something a little weirder, a little different, maybe even echoing into the Carl Jung collective overmind type of thing? Like, how is there this intrinsic connection to consciousness? And how are they able to respond to just the thoughts in your mind to give you that evidence that you required, even if it's just subjective and you don't video it, you've just got your own subjective experience? That's the deepest section of this. And you can't just jump into that kind of thing with the uninitiated, because it's too absurd, it's too outlandish, it's too hard to really digest. So I understand, you know, the template that's being built. And I think it's our responsibility as people that look into this quite deeply and spend a lot of our time trying to educate others to bring that deeper trench into the public discourse in a way that's acceptable. And that's at least what I'm trying my best to do, is to present those more hard to digest aspects of this conversation in a way that is a little easier and a bit more palatable for people. And that's still a difficult dance, because you are introducing very wild concepts. I mean, the idea of me being in my back garden and projecting thoughts and having orange orbs fly across the sky and hover over my house, I mean, that is, you know, that's something that my own family took a little bit of time and convincing to truly think, okay, he hasn't had a psychotic breakdown. He's not just hallucinating. He genuinely has had these experiences. And fortunately, I'm blessed with an open-minded family who have recognized what I'm doing now and support it and appreciate it and believe me when it comes to those things. But this is that deeper element of the subject that I would like to see permeating wider, but I can understand why that's something that, at least from like a governmental perspective, is not an easy conversation to have.
That's right. And governments are there to basically, you know, they're there to maintain order. After they begin to approach a subject that implicates, you know, a fallout of order and, you know, possibly the disintegration of institutions and the, you know, turning over of certain religions in particular, and it's scary for them, but, you know, for a lot of people, it's just fanciful in their mind. It just short, you know, that's the process I was going through. It was like, you know, as a lawyer, I look at balance of probabilities in civil litigation and beyond reasonable doubt in the criminal law. And, you know, I think that when we look at whistleblowers, and Dave Grush is a whistleblower, let's be clear. When you look at the likes of the whistleblower, you have to act on reasonableness. And, you know, is this on a balance of probabilities likely to be the truth? And I am firmly in the camp and support the belief that, or I'm persuaded by the evidence that he is totally legit. And people need to understand that the information that he's reporting is classified and he can't just produce documents. It would have been great to see certain documents in the debrief article that came out. And I commend Leslie Kane and Ralph Blumenthal for getting that article out, because it was looking quite hairy at one point in terms of whether, you know, there was going to be an outlet that would take it forward. And, you know, I congratulate them. It's a great article. But, you know, this is the issue with the subject. It's very much firmly in the hands of the intelligence community, the military, and as we've seen the most recent legislative bill, in the hands of contractors. And it's sad because nobody, in my view, owns this subject. It's open to anybody and everyone that is interested in it, whether you're factually researching, you're doing observational ufology, you're an experiencer, you're doing both, you know, like I do and you. No one owns this. And honestly, the word you used a few moments ago is initiation. It is an initiation. And that implies a radical change in perception and a change in state, in inner state. This is what it's all about. And, you know, I have a great respect for my my contacts and peers in the military, in the intelligence community, in the scientific community. But what I like to engender is this sense of equality, because we're all equals in this. And it's not just about the intellect. And, you know, I had a chat with Jacques Vallée about this. And he even, you know, as a scientist, he said to me that if we get too scientific, and I think the term might be scientism, we're going to miss the point. And, you know, basic errors will happen. We're going to miss, you know, what may be in time obvious, but at the moment we're missing it because we're just, you know, adhering to a certain set of beliefs or a system of approach that doesn't, it's insufficient to get the full panoramic view of the subject. And I think, you know, somebody like Jacques is super impressive to me, because he captures the esoteric and the scientific and balances or harmonizes the two. And he was well ahead of his time. And the other person I want to pay tribute to, who's passed away some years ago, is John Keel, who was an investigative journalist who wrote about, you know, the amazing experiences that others had. But then he'd write books or put in the back end of one of his books, such as Operation Trojan Horse, what was happening to him along the way in the process of investigating. And it just blew my mind. But, you know, I have a special place in my heart and an intellectual respect for these two particular authors and researchers, because frankly, when I started to experience, these guys were the only ones that made sense to me according to what I was experiencing. And it just gave me a grounding in a time where I'm asking myself, am I sane? Am I well? Yes, it seems like I am. But, you know, there was nowhere to turn. Now there's a lot more people that you can go to. There's a community, and it's you know, it's a very disparate community. There's a lot of infighting and overly aggressive opinions that are being forced one way and the other. I think everyone just needs to calm down and just you know, learn to sit with an opinion of somebody else and just let it percolate. You know, if you react really strongly to a certain position, assuming that, you know, there's a basic modicum of respect you know, reasonableness, it's fine. Just sit with it, let it be. You don't have to manufacture straw man arguments in response and kind of let your prejudices and conditionings take over. And you know, that's the approach that I really try to inculcate, and that's just to maintain a balance. So, you know, I can be very much into consciousness and altered states of consciousness, but at the same time, I've literally disciplined myself to get to know how the US government works, and, you know, even things down to authorizations and pay attention to how this works, because at the end of the day, we need to bridge both worlds of the study. And there's more than two worlds. There's the scientific side as well. There's sociological. There's now a group of actually amazing female researchers in the economics section, former Bank of England economist and a former economist to the George Bush administration, Pippa Malgrim. So, I mean, there's some amazing people coming forward. I want to pay tribute to the likes of Dr. Aya Whiteley, who is at the University College of London and is a psychologist in space medicine, who is just so ahead of her time in the way that she thinks and is dealing with things like a global language and language for children as they're developing in an early stage of life. And, you know, we are living in incredible times, but, you know, we have to start from somewhere. And I think that this paradoxical stuff that's coming out of the US and the government is a good starting point. And, you know, I don't buy all the kind of prosaic explanations around it. There is a paradox around these data points, but the paradox can be resolved if we're prepared to entertain and speculate that there's an external intelligence or intelligences that is actually interacting with perhaps some of the government and military mechanics at play. And I'm not saying that it is, but it's something that I sense as a legitimacy. And, you know, I think that what we're seeing is a step plan of some kind. It's not obvious in terms of, it's not a, you know, kumbaya arm to arm approach. It's a group of people that are motivated to put this through the democratic machinery in the United States. It started 3 weeks and 3 weeks and 3 days ago in terms of, you know, the current avalanche of stuff we're seeing. I mean, this goes back for decades, but, you know, in terms of the magnifying glass that we're talking about now, we saw this amazing opening of the artillery, as I call it, by Christopher Mellon in an article that he wrote, I think it was the 3rd of June, and it was incredible. I think it was, if the government has UAP or UFO materials or crash materials, it's time to reveal them. I mean, what a statement. And something about the benefits of humanity outweigh, you know, the fear that we're not alone in the universe.
Yes, especially, like, especially coming from the former deputy assistant SecDef, like, you know.
Correct. Correct. It was such a well-written article, and it just sort of, you know, it was clearly premeditated, of course, somebody like that. But, you know, Chris was talking about the fact he'd referred witnesses, four witnesses, to Aero, the, Jay, help me out here, the anomaly,
the all-domain anomaly resolution office.
Resolving case by case, everything, or not. So yes, he referred witnesses that, you know, who claim to have had knowledge of secret US government programs, the analysis and exploitation of materials recovered from off-world craft, and the word craft is used in the the new intelligence legislation that's just been put out in bill format. So, you know, and he questions the leadership of Aero, thankfully, and sort of is showing that this is not your source of information, American and world public, that we should be just relying on. You know, it's incredible. But there was an Aero hearing that actually surpassed expectations, in that they were showing concrete cases and photos of metallic spheres, for example. There was a sphere over Mosul in Iraq, and that these types of objects are the most common. I think they account for something like 70-odd%. I could be wrong there, don't quote me. But, you know, there was some positive stuff to come out. We've had a sort of a NASA talking shop event, which was a bit of a non-event, in my opinion. It was a lot of well-intentioned, but relatively ignorant people that were giving anecdotal accounts as to why it could be easily explained, including a former NASA astronaut, bless him. But, you know, no disrespect. But, you know, that article came out on the 3rd of June, and it talks about this U.S. government being in the possession of advanced non-human technology, that a successful reverse engineering program might bring about a revolution in energy, transportation, materials that we use in technologies, of course. But yeah, at the same time, this Pentagon all-domain resolution office in the Pentagon hasn't discovered any verifiable info to substantiate, which is, frankly, you know, not something I would readily believe.
Yeah, frankly, a little suspicious.
To put it politely, yeah. So that was an amazing opening of the artillery, that, you know, you imagine like D-Day, the battleships were just pounding the landing beaches in Normandy from, you know, the coast before the troops come in. And then the troops did show up in the form of, you know, I'm using this allegory of Dave Grush, who came forward in the wake of that following week. And he's a decorated former combat officer. He served in Afghanistan, a veteran. I think it's the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency.
Yep. Also the National Reconnaissance Office.
Exactly. And he was on their desk, basically, for UAP. It was like 2019 to 21. He was like a co-lead, and he also worked on the UAP task force before we got to Aero at the Pentagon. So, you know, an impressive set of credentials. He seems very decent to me. I think he's very clean from what I know, people that know him personally and have known him for some time. And, you know, he admits, I had no direct interaction with the craft or any beings, but what's being reported to me is classified, and I was appalled by what I was told, because this should be in the public domain, especially when it implies huge amounts of defense budget that's being put into it. So, you know, he's given testimony to the House Permanent Select Committee, the Senate Select Committee for Intelligence, which we'll get into in a bit, the ODNI Inspector General of the Intelligence Community, and that's the Office of the Director of National Intelligence that kind of released the first, you know, official U.S. government document, the preliminary review, which came out in June of 21, a 10-page document, which was groundbreaking, even though it was very, you know, simplistic in how it admitted the fact that this stuff's real. And then, of course, Dave's testimony was a proof for release by the DOPSR, which is Defense Office of Publication and Review, or Security Review, something like that. So, you know, it's as good as it gets when we're dealing with classified information. And we are literally in the process of watching a real life episode or episodes of The X-Files. Like, it's amazing. I call it the real X-Files because, you know, I don't know about you, Jay, but I used to watch that series when it came out, and it just felt so authentic in terms of, you know, the more serious storylines about non-human visitors and reverse engineering of craft. But even some of the kind of more, let's say, outlandish episodes about shapeshifters and stuff. Look at Skinwalker Ranch. This is what, you know, defense and government contractor guys have seen. And they're not making it up. So, you know, it's almost like the art imitating life, as they say.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. I mean, it's such an expansive topic that you do have to approach it in a certain way to begin with, as we were saying, this kind of initiation process for the wider public. And, you know, as much as people would love to have, as you said, seen David Grush bring out documentation or photographic evidence, this is a process and it is classified. He can't just do that. He can't just throw it out all on the table. And we are hearing the murmurs and the rumors and basically now the confirmations that there are people who have had direct first-hand access and experience. They are talking to people. We've recently had Marco Rubio going on media on News Nation and saying that he's spoken directly with these people. So I would say that there is a you know, a process of acclimation. You can't just throw it all out on the table. Someone like Dave Grush coming out is, I would say, a significant catalyst towards bringing this to the forefront and allowing there to be space for the next stage, which will be a discussion of direct access. And also, let me just clear my throat. Also, as you were saying previously with Jacques Vallée talking about how we're essentially inadequate with our current models in science to truly understand this. And also going back to what you said about thinking you want to see something and it turns up. This to me is that element of a symbiosis, which I've said many times. That's why I've called Project Unity, this science spirit symbiosis that I think has to occur. And I would almost say that it's almost like the UFO is representative of that. Like, it's kind of saying to us, hey, these two polarities need to be put together. And when you do that properly, with enough technological sophistication, with enough consciousness sophistication, you will get a flying saucer. This is what this is. It's like a...
Shape is extremely relevant. I wasn't going to talk about this, but you have hit the nail on the head, Jay. And we're talking about archetypes and the UFO. And like you mentioned in the introduction of where the consciousness component comes in, you know, the grandfather of the archetypes is Carl Jung. And, you know, he publicly was sort of, I think he denied publicly the fact that UFOs were real, but privately he completely was into this. And in fact, his last ever work was about UFOs. He's talking about these models in the human psyche that are contained in the human psyche, which are projecting individually and collectively, you know, a feedback system. Whereas in philosophy, for example, archetypes are ideal forms of more specific objects. And you know, we can go into the Greek philosophy of Plato, who promulgated the notion that there's sort of like pure perfect form or archetypes, and that this is common to objects in reality generally. But, you know, I think he wrote a book called Man and His Symbols and Approaching the Unconscious. And he talks about these mythological images or motifs, that's the word. That what we're seeing are just these consciousness representations that are just coming back to us. And I think it's not just simplistically, we are creating everything that we see. I think there is a massive part of that, but it's a play. But there's also, we're in an electromagnetic soup of energy, and there's interacting, let's say, intelligences that are interacting with us and our consciousness. You mentioned it about, you know, thinking of something and then you get a feedback. Well, you know, in esoterica, we call that the noosphere, which is where you get the word nous, you know, you use your nous. So there's a mental plane that is interacting, we're interacting with. Maybe then we're overlaying these kind of Jungian symbols or archetypes, that's the term. And that's what we're seeing. And, you know, that's why we keep seeing them or have seen them in this, in the folklore, in the myths, the stories, the most perennial examples of literature. And, you know, I'll refer readers to Jacques Vallée's book, Passport to Magonia, which was a great read when I started to experience stuff. So, you know, and he talks about the collective unconscious. So it's operating at this massive level that we're not aware of. He talks about core archetypes. There's the shadow, that anima, the persona. There's all these different terms. And these are things that are just inherent to reality. But, you know, I think it was in the 1950s and 58, from memory, something like that, that Jung concluded that it was more desirable for people to believe in UFOs, that they exist, than to believe that they don't. But I think he was privately convinced, and he was more concerned about public perception of his interests, which, like most people are, including the US government today, like we were just talking about. But it was in one of his final works, and it was just simply called Flying Saucers. And there's this kind of picture of a shadow being with these kind of like bright eyes. And Jung used that book as an attempt to answer why it was more desirable to believe in their existence. And he concluded that, you know, these UFOs are examples of the phenomena, which I love and experience like you do, and that's synchronicity, where you have these external events that mirror internal psychic states or inner states. And, you know, he saw this UFO situation as a broader, in a broader perspective than most. And he said that, you know, that this was happening, the shape of the saucer, which is how we got into this, is symbolic of this ending of an era and the beginning of a new one. And he's talking about psychic dominance. I think that's the term he uses. So he's saying that nature has a clock, and, you know, this active clock is continually moving and passing from one cycle to another. And these vital periods that we're unaware of cause us to experience social and psychological changes to the life of us individually, but also as a society globally and nationally. And, you know, this is distinct as an individual, obviously, to the life of the collective. And the individual, as he thought, is bound by the collective, by the change in archetype or the psychic dominant to that of the collective. So, you know, in a way, he was kind of saying that it's similar to what the medieval alchemists projected. They were projecting their psyche into matter. And Jung felt that, I think, modern man projected his inner state into the heavens. So in this sense, the UFOs became modern symbols for the ancient gods who came to man's assistance in a time of need. So it's I think he got a lot right. And, you know, we talk about, I know Graham Hancock mentioned this and brought this into the mainstream, the precession of the equinox, and I think it's every 2100 years. And this corresponds to what was called the Great Platonic Year, which is every 25,000 years. And It was either Jung or maybe it was Mamie Palmer Hall that talked about this passing from, you know, a period of water signs to air. So Pisces to Aquarius, which is where we get that kind of the dawning of the age of Aquarius, that kind of thing. And in ancient Egypt, the sign for Aquarius were these like two parallel jagged lines. So like the fluid or the water of life. And it also means air. So he's talking about this movement of energy in space above the firmament, as distinct to the waters beneath the firmament. So in this sense, the UFOs kind of became like this modern symbols for the ancient gods. And that's it was fascinating because this was in the 50s, early 50s. We're still in the Cold War. It's actually the beginning of the Cold War, if I remember. And UFOs start to infiltrate popular culture. And, you know, we're at a time of massive fragmentation in the world, which is kind of still what's happening now at the moment, obviously, with Russia and Ukraine. And, you know, these are just expressions of the same schism in human consciousness and the separation of self. And, you know, Jung concluded that mankind was and is passing through this period or periods of mass hysteria. And, you know, it's arising from these common causes of pressure, which is the threat of nuclear war, which is very much where we are today. So he's not saying that, you know, because of mass hysteria, the UFOs are not real, but he's saying that the UFOs are appearing due to the presence of mass hysteria. So there's a distinction. And the shape of the UFO is, of course, that kind of, well, the classical one from the 50s and that we still see and record now is the saucer. And it's, you know, it's elliptical, it's whole. It's like it's a symbol of wholeness and unity, project unity. And, you know, for him, for Jung, the shape of this saucer was round. It's the shape of the ancient mandala from, you know, the ancient Vedic periods in India. According to the Buddhists, this symbol of wholeness, and it's been there throughout history. You get it in, I think, the Hindu deity of Vishnu, the preserver, protector of man. You know, you have what's called Sudarshan Chakra, which is this spinning light disc, which is like a weapon of Vishnu. And this is the national symbol of India. If you check out the flag of India, this amazing pattern or weapon is on the flag. And Sudarshan Chakra is something like the meaning of the disc of auspicious vision, because Sudarshan means vision. It has 108 serrated edges, and there's 108 nadis or energy centers or meridians in the human body. I mentioned the word Sudarshan. It's Sanskrit, I've remembered. So it's a combination of two words. So Su, which means divine, and Darshana, which means vision. I have a friend called Darshana. So it translates to divine vision. And it's within this sort of iconography of Lord Vishnu, this Hindu deity, and it's fascinating. I mean, we could just go on and on, but you see, though, this is where it leads. We've gone from, you know,
national security to ancient Sanskrit.
Yeah, that's it. It's actually schizophrenic.
But that is the point of this subject, is that, yes, there is a technical aspect. Yes, there is a material aspect. There certainly is. But the tougher thing to digest is that there is a esoteric, ephemeral, philosophical, dare I say spiritual, component to this whole thing. And, you know, we live in a world now which is, especially in the West, you know, so materially driven, so reduced down to kind of like a basic perspective of matter and reality, which is now being challenged by our developments in technology, in quantum computation, in our advanced physics models, in our probing into consciousness through the medium of science, as has been demonstrated through the resurgence of psychedelic study and things like this. So it feels like we're approaching a time where the lens that we perceive reality is becoming more accommodating for this type of more esoteric perspective, which doesn't surprise me in relation to the UFO subject and the reasons why it might be getting discussed now, because it does feel like we're approaching a period in the human story
where these two components are coming closer together. And like I said, I do feel like in some ways the UFO is representative of this symbiosis between these two, what are at the moment kind of diametrically opposing worldviews of spirit and science. So it is fascinating that you have this archetype that seems to be saying to humanity, hey, look, you've got to combine these two things. The reason why you guys are so lost and you're so confused and you're fighting and you're warring is because you haven't realized this intrinsic connection between mind and matter, between spirit
right.
and science. And so, you know, Terence McKenna said this a lot, that the UFO is this kind of symbol of the shadow of human potential just hovering above the skies in front of us saying, look, this is where you need to be going. And, you know, do you feel like, for example, the growing sophistication in AI and quantum computation and these merging elements of what kind of almost feel like quite esoteric sciences could be a reason for government disclosure, could be a reason for opening up this discussion?
I think it's completely relevant. And these are the types of discussions I'm having with AI experts. And even within, you know, esoteric organizations, this is something that's being considered. I literally received an article yesterday from a French contact who shared, you know, what the Masons' view on AI is, and you know, how we as spiritual or divine beings that are shrouded in flesh and, you know, made of matter, have to shape this stuff, this AI, because it will exceed our intelligence, and but it may not reach a degree of wisdom. And in fact, in seeking to become more like us, if let's just assume for a second that, you know, we have these divine sparks that we call the soul, imagine that this is a truth and that this is something that science can't really measure, and that we're having to, you know, kind of go back over millennia and look at this, as you've said, the science of spirituality, the science of the soul. How does AI reconcile that? And, you know, it was only yesterday I was mentioning a very famous mass contact case called amicizia, which means friendship in Italian. And this is the biggest mass contact case that we're aware of, in as far as I'm aware. And this happened across Italy and Europe in, I want to say, the late 60s to the early to mid 80s, where these human visitors, let's call them, that were varied in their description. Some were very tall, some were not. They basically befriended, you know, the likes of university lecturers and engineers, that kind of thing. And they were saying, we're literally on the run from a now embodied AI that we created that's hunting us down. It sounds like a science fiction film, but this is like the biggest mass contact case that we're aware of. We're talking about over 200 and something people, which is a pretty big, you know, charade to hold. So, you know, it's there, it's in the films. And, you know, I spoke to an AI CEO last week. And he said that, you know, in the background, there was this agreement for a moratorium, which is, you know, to stop the development of AI for 6 months across all the big players in the market, Elon Musk and Google. It didn't happen. And yet there are these real heavyweights sort of warning about it, because, you know, there's intelligence, but there's also an aspect of wisdom. And we are, what makes us unique is our human spirit. And if we go to the Vedic tradition, they say that the human spirit resides in the heart, in the left ventricle of the heart. And again, these are things that are subtle, that are invisible, that you can't recreate through technology. No matter how, you know, advanced it gets, even quantum computing states, it's a manipulation of and a transit through different states of reality. But, you know, it doesn't get to that human dimension, which is what I think reality and the UAP subject is all about. Instead of looking at the subject as something outside of ourselves, like Jung was trying to tell us, we need to look within us. And, you know, why is it that the beings that are reported have five limbs like us? And, you know, the five-pointed star is a symbol of, you know, the human, the soul. And the light within the human being that makes us different to biological AI, you know, assuming this thing is real and that's what's really going on. And, you know, we play all these games. We're playing games around, you know, intellectual games that are really very futile. And, you know, just look at what came out with the government disclosure by Dave Grush. I call it the Italian job because this is what it's an Italian appropriated craft that has been legally disclosed because it's the only crash retrieval incident that occurred outside of the US. So unlike Roswell or Sirocco or Trinity or Aztec. So, you know, this was not from the direct result of US military operations. And technically, the US government has no control over information or dissemination of information that might cause a diplomatic incident because it occurred in Italy in 1933 outside of Milan. I think it was called magenta, which is a beautiful color. So, you know, there are all these kind of semantics and games that are being played. And they're just, in the end, like in my humble opinion, these things are futile. They're temporary. They're of man's mind, which is so flawed. And I think there are greater intelligences or a greater intelligence, singular, that is beyond all of this stuff. And that's why the games can only last so long, that secrecy is only as good as the ability to shroud it from people through manipulating them, because maybe we have these innate abilities that allowed us to pierce the veil of secrecy, and that, you know, that is what we call revelation, or, you know, there's nothing's hidden. It's just that we're revealing things through our own effort, through our own cultivation spiritually and psychically to see through these things. So, you know, I see a lot of games being played. I do respect the military. I respect the armed forces. I have friends in the UK and elsewhere that come from those kinds of families. This is not a critique on the sacrifice and the bravery of the armed forces. It's just about, it's a general statement about the state of affairs of human thinking, and that it doesn't apply correctly to the subject, and that we are, no pun intended, shooting ourselves in the foot by doing that. You know, and we're learning about this in the context of what was a publicly unknown Cold War. And, you know, it sounds like the US, this is nothing new to the research that you and I have come across, but to the public, they'll be reading that, oh my God, there's been potentially an 80-year or 90-year arms race, an unknown Cold War between these adversary nations for recovered and exploited physical materials, and that they're having to identify these UAP crashes or landings, retrieving the materials for exploitation and reverse engineering to garner these, I think the term is asymmetric national defense advantages. So there's all this terminology and stuff at play. But in my opinion, this is just a small part of the pie of the mystery, let's call it. You know, we learned about the fact that the Canadian government or military are also part of this game. You know, the Canadian Defense Research and Development group, or I think it's the DRDC, and they existed, actually they came into existence soon after Roswell, like the CIA, you know,
so, CIA, US.
Is that a coincidence?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and I think they're like the equivalent of the US DARPA. So they've been working on this stuff since the 50s. You have this letter from a Canadian MP that CCs, carbon copies, this major general, Michael Wright, commander of the Canadian Forces for Intelligence Command. And it's just astounding. I'm sorry I'm laughing, because it's incredible. It's incredible. We're seeing these machinations of human gameplay on something that's completely non-human and, you know, stands to benefit as far greater by putting this outside of the military and defense sphere into responsible education and study and science. There needs to be this responsible transmission. And, you know, the fact that we're talking about craft obviously implies there are potentially pilots, like Dave Grush mentioned, or unmanned craft. You know, he even went as far to say, I'm not going to say this is extraterrestrial. It could be coming from another dimension, and it's maintaining a physical form in our physical reality.
I think that's an important point, because this is like extraterrestrial is not a term that's being used. Non-human. And so like, I think that that's an extremely important like linguistic strategy that's being deployed here, because they don't want to say alien. Why don't they want to say that? Is it because they know that it's actually beyond the veil of something that's not actually space-time as we understand it?
That's right. I remember some years ago, Jay, I was doing some research around FBI documents, and there was this random two-pager that was on the FBI files, and it was like, I think it was, the context of the document was completely obscure and unclear, but it was entitled something like The Round Robin, and it just had this bullet point, 1 to 10, what we think they are, and it was really well done, and it talks about they may be coming from other densities or equivalent to what the Buddhists call the locus. And I just thought, oh my God.
Dude, when I found that, I was sitting there like, holy shit, they're actually saying these things.
They said it. And honestly, that is exactly what I've experienced. They materialize and dematerialize.
Yes.
Which means that I suppose that they are transcending space and time, and they're in parallel to this reality, or they're bleeding through. Excuse me, I've got a frog in my throat. So, you know, I just felt this document is sound. It looks authentic. It was from the 40s, but they'd already realized so much, and they were, you know, it was so succinct, and it just felt completely accurate based on my own experiences and reading books, that kind of thing. And I just kind of kept a copy of it because I thought, I think this is going to probably be relevant in time to come. And here we are, you know, less than a decade later, and you know. We just had the Intelligence Authorization Act 24 draft bill come out. And I know there are some very heavyweight people that have been involved with the drafting of this. And, you know, it's like all kudos to this Senate Committee on Intelligence that's actually taken this initiative. You know, I think there is a sophisticated game behind this that is not obvious to the general public and to the kind of uninitiated you know,
and even to us, you know, outside of the closed doors and corridors of the intelligence community, you know, we have our inroads and our connections to people from that type of world. But even to people who are dedicating, you know, extremely profound amounts of time and effort and energy into looking into this subject, we're still out of the loop. We're still out of the loop of what's really happening in the background of this discussion. And I think that that's... you know, this is another issue. I mean, we know as people that research this issue that this has been going on for, I mean, in terms of the phenomenon, it could have been going on for millennia. But in terms of government interaction, let's say 70, 80 years of obfuscation. And it's very clear. It's obvious. It's been even said, even by people like David Grush, that there has been a mass disinformation campaign generationally. There's been intelligence interference on this issue for decades, which has stoked the stigma and the knee-jerk laughter reactions. And I think that, you know, the issue we have within the research field is a lot of people are weary and suspicious and tired and know that there is so much bullshit coming from the IC over the decades that when someone like David Grush takes to the podium, people... it's split into camps. You know, people don't know how to feel. There are those who are just like, yep, dude's a hero. I can't believe this is happening. This is incredible. But I'm seeing it. You know, you're seeing it. We're seeing the chatter. There's a lot of people who are saying this is a psyop. I don't trust this guy. I think that they're trying to mess with us because we've become so kind of, I guess, almost battle hardened by all of the disinformation and noise that it when something this profound occurs, where you've got an extremely high level senior US intelligence official with an incredible background just point blank saying reverse engineering programs are real, bodies have been recovered, we want to believe it. But there is a proportion of the population of the research community that go, yeah, this is too good to be true. No, I don't trust it. Yeah, I don't trust it.
And I bring that back to this sort of legal burden of proof, because
right,
it's not just a so-called witness. He is, by all intents and purposes, a witness. He's being represented by the former Inspector General of the intelligence community, his lawyer. And there was some sort of little sideshows trying to suggest that his lawyers had distanced from him. Complete BS. Not the case. He's going to be continually represented by, you know, this illustrious figure that knows what he's doing. And I just think we have to be reasonable. Look at all the facts that have been corroborated and the circumstances in which, blow by blow, he has come forward and produced his story. And the story is credible. He checks out. He's clean. It doesn't get any better, you know, from within the classified world, in my view. And, you know, I can't persuade anybody, but I know based on my own interactions and so forth, he's a good man and he's well surrounded. He is telling the truth. He is who he says he is. And you know what? I want to pay a heartfelt tribute to our friend Ross Coulthart, who has worked this story relentlessly. He's, you know, done all of his due diligence as he should on this story. And it's amazing that he did this interview and got this visually out to the public. And, you know, I'm very happy to see the likes of Russell Brand embracing this.
Yeah.
You know, Russell is a spiritual person. He's been through hell and back with drug addiction. He's been around the block of life. And what he says makes a lot of sense. And I like the fact that somebody with that kind of exposure and following is giving Ross the time to actually, you know, put his story out even further to,
yeah. Well, I mean, he's basically the Joe Rogan of the UK at this point.
Yeah. And you know, I just want to tip my hat to Ross, who's coming on a tour to Egypt with myself and our good friend Nick Cook, the author of The Hunt for Zero Point and director on the...
Maybe me, if I can acquiesce the funds.
You've got to, yeah, try to. But I mean, I'm just plugging here shamelessly, but, you know, it's done an amazing job. And, you know, I think that what we have seen is a tipping point. And when in time to come, we're going to look back at this tipping point and go, my God, look at what happened and how it happened and when it happened and the sequential order. Because the next thing, Jay, I'm speculating here, speculate. If there's craft that we're talking about, if we're now starting to, you know, start to question pilots and dead bodies, it's inexorably going towards the fact that there are beings. And if I was the government or the intelligence community, and I was committed to sharing this with the public, which personally, I see no interest for any government to maintain order or intelligence community to release anything at all. We have to ask why this is happening at all in any shape or form.
Yeah, yeah.
Between parentheses. I'm losing the plot here. It's just too much. There's been so much going on. But look, we're talking about beings. And if I was a betting man, I would see other witnesses coming out, credible witnesses that are flanking the likes of Dave Grosh, who are saying, there's some good guys or beings, or we're being helped. Why are we being helped? Why are they introducing themselves? Is there any connection between this external non-human intelligence, we're calling it that, and not extraterrestrial? And does that have anything to do with this, the fact that this government process is happening at all? Is that a reality? Is there a biting point, an interaction between the mechanics of the government and the intelligence world and this so-called non-human intelligence? Because to me, that resolves many of these strange paradoxes that we're seeing and kind of strange behavior and questions as to, you know, are we being played like in a sile? You know, one minute we're seeing this, the next minute we're seeing that. Maybe there's a shaping of something that is outside of the control of government and, you know, the intelligence community. Look at the paper, a wonderful short paper that Hal put together in July of last year, I think it was, 22, called The Ultra-Terrestrials. And in that paper, Hal, you know, sets out and speculates on all the different potential sources of this non-human intelligence. What if all of the above apply? It's not any one particular source. What if there is one or two or more of this, of these sort of subsets that have some kind of involvement with this that you and I are not aware of? You know, I just think that it's a massive risk for governments, just any government, to just put this out there. And for me, there's a process, there's a purpose, and there's a step plan. And we are literally heading towards the end of the beginning. And yet it feels like a complete roller coaster. And, you know, we love talking about ontological shock, but it's only just beginning. And it's a real issue. Like, ontological shock is a real thing. And we need to be ready for people that are not, you know, looking into this enough, because they're trying to make ends meet and get on with life.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, we talked about government, and going back into a little bit into the philosophical, when we talk about ontology, I think of Martin Heidegger, who is he's one of the most famous philosophers there are, but he's, you know, he was quite controversial. He was around during Nazi Germany, and there's some controversy around him and that, but his thinking was incredible. And, you know, he spoke about the witnessing of revelations, or a revolutionary type of breakthrough that happens within human life. And it means this departure from customs that we know, from customary human forms of life and the parameters within which, you know, we understand. And this applies in warfare and anything. I mean, this is totally linked to geopolitics and the military powers of the world, you know, and how we've been conducting ourselves, interacting as humans, as a human society, between countries throughout the course of recorded history. And where this is all going and what this is leading to is what your friend Richard Dolan coined as the breakaway civilization. And this is allegoric and very much physical breakaway from the majority. And I was talking about ontology, and Heidegger talks about this difference in ontology. You have, you know, ontology in the sense that we understand, and then what he called, I think it was fundamental ontology. And he wrote this seminal book called In Being and Time. And he draws this sharp distinction between ontical, which is basically physical and factual, and then the ontological, which is the philosophy and more about the why of being or beings. And he was obsessed with this idea of being. And, you know, he said that there is this ontological difference and this distinction. And he developed this concept of fundamental ontology. So he's saying that traditional ontology asks, why is there anything? Whereas Heidegger would say, what does it mean for something to be? There's a distinction. And, you know, he's saying that this ontology is fundamentally different relative to this traditional why, because it concerns the understanding of what any given being or entity, such as us as human beings, presupposes. So it's, you know, our understanding of that by which we are. And, you know, it's a big thing. And it's this sort of inquiry that is required to understand the shape of the human experience. And he calls this, the German word, I think, is Dasein, D-A-S-E-I-N, and then being. And, you know, he says that's the basis of all the sciences in this 1927 book, Being and Time. So, you know, we're looking at this radical destruction and departure of what we know to something completely unknown. And we're not at the apex of the pyramid anymore. And it's a precipice, this revolutionary breakthrough that means a departure from our customary known forms of life and ways of life. We have to look at it from a warfare military perspective as well, obviously, from the technological side. And imagine there is this X factor, this third party or parties that are interacting somehow or watching, and I don't know, quasi interacting. I don't know. But, you know, it's massive, and this is what we're starting to see the beginning of. And it's destructive. It's totally destructive. This, as Heidegger would have called it, Abau. And it's a deconstruction. And, you know, you have French disciples that followed his work and developed it. And he really kind of delved into this idea of destruction and then building, or Bau in German, from the rudimentary German that I can recall learning about. I mean, so it's a worldview change. It's almost a form of psychological warfare because of the new information that's coming in. So a lot of people won't want to touch it. It's about dismantling of the paradigms and ideologies that have been blindly adhered to until now. And we see that with the legacy media who just simply don't want to touch this. You know, I speak cautiously, maybe they will pick it up now, but it's been very limited. And so, you know, it's a time of unconcealment. And there's another thing that I think I should mention about Heidegger. And, you know, we talk about other dimensions and time and space. And this is where philosophy is so important to understand the physics or the quantum physics, is that, you know, as I said earlier, and we discussed this, this is really about the human story that's being projected and, you know, built with these non-human intelligences or intelligence. And Heidegger says that, you know, time can't flow backwards. It's forward flowing. And even if the past is history, is revisable, it's in this process of being revised, but time is moving forward, just as it was before history was changed by others. And it will always be moving forward after any revisions. You know, so to say that time flows backwards, which is kind of absurd if we want to start exploring dimensions. And
unless you're a neutrino, because a neutrino does go backwards.
But from a human perspective, as the observer, maybe it's just an absurdity. And that's what Heidegger suggested. It made sense to me. And we, you know, there's so much kind of woo talk out of there. And I just think we need to, you know, reinvigorate the philosophical. And Heidegger's, for me, the man on this. And, you know, he says that time is a phenomenon of consciousness. So human consciousness, the human story.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're looking at this forward-oriented existential structure that interprets the past in this anticipatory manner with a view to future aims and projections. So anyway, that's in the Being and Time book. And I think that there's probably something to it. I can't prove it, but
yeah. Well, we're looking at another transitional state from the status quo. This is just part of the human story. I mean, we have had countless status quos through time, which are here. We figured it out. We put it in a box. The world is flat. You will fall off of it if you go to the end of the oceans. Oh, wait, no, it's a globe. And so, like, you know, all through time, all through human civilization, we have had moments of surety that suddenly get shaken up and disrupted, and we adapt. And evolutionary developmental processes, whether it be genetic or epigenetic, there is a destructive process involved in that. And that's not comfortable. I mean, I've said this so many times recently, people are probably getting fed up of it, but I still think it's true that even outside of, you know, macro evolutionary processes, global development, or just the human story, your individual life is full of destruction and transformation. You know, moments where nothing seems right and there's no hope left, and oh my god, you know, it's never going to change, and then it changes, then it does change, and you reflect back and you look at the necessary components of destruction that did take place: birthing from the fire, the phoenix rising from the ashes. You know, this is a symbolic but very true to life way of looking at your development and trajectory through evolution, whether it's as a collective species or whether it's just as an individual navigating through becoming older and wiser and growing. And so it's just inherent to the system of development that there is a component of uncomfortable transition and destruction. And I think we're definitely seeing that. This is, to me, such an important moment in human history. I mean, we've gone through so many transitions and changes, but right now, my God, like, there's just so much of it, you know, not even just with UFOs, just in general. We are in a really turbulent, tumultuous kind of situation on a global scale, from geopolitics to society in large, and just in every sort of domain that has a level of importance for the trajectory. There is disruption and there is change and there is transition. And the UFO element is such a major disruptor of where we've placed our little box of parameters, that it's going to force people into that, like we were just saying about ontological shock, which is why you're seeing, as we both are friends with Diana Pasolka, why you're seeing the Vatican doing its preparatory types of disclosures.
if there is other life out there, they are brothers and sisters in God and children of God also, telling their people not to worry too much about this because there is this ontological...
It's compatible. Don't worry, everybody.
It's compatible, guys. Like, yeah, we're not yet. There are other beings, but they're all children of God. It's going to be okay. But, you know, this is necessary. And I think when you're at a position where we are right now, where there's just so much disruption and turbulence, I have to look at it again from the perspective of my own life and go, right, okay, you know what? The most disruptive, the most dark, the most hard to deal with moments in my life were actually the most important. And they were in long term, the most rewarding, not easy to see at the time, almost impossible to see at the time. I think one of the elements of growing and getting wiser is trying your best when you hit that peak and then go back down into a valley, trying your best to recognize the importance of that valley. Why are you back down when you were up a minute ago? Because there is a necessary component of self-realization and self-actualization and development that comes from recognizing these components of the human experience. When you're going through hardship and you're going through tough times, it's very difficult to see the reason behind it. But with reflection, with introspection, you do recognize the components kind of building you up to who you are now and who you will later be in life. So I think that that is definitely representative on a collective scale. And right now, I would say it's the best evidence that we're going through some major sort of transformation because the turbulence is almost unbearable. And I've said this quote a few times, so people are probably getting tired of it, but I do have an unapologetic love affair with Terence McKenna, and I think he might actually haunt my brain a little bit. He lives rent-free in my head. But
he's great.
One of my favorite quotes from him is that, you know, it is the responsibility of the human species to transform from a camel into an F-16 mid-flight. And I like that because it says to me that, yeah, it's this necessary streamlining of our movement through evolution. Things are happening faster and faster and faster. And one of the elements of that is going to be that G-forces are building up on your structure. And you're going to need to shrug off the unnecessary elements that are holding you back as you start accelerating through evolution. So we're at a moment right now where there's like structures that have to be shrugged off, models that have to be changed, perspectives that have to be transitioned because it's becoming literally inadequate to where we are. It's becoming it's holding us back. Our current state of perspective on reality is now no longer suited for where we are ending up. So the idea that you have to transform yourself from a slow moving creature into a much more streamlined vehicle of movement is very, very akin to where we are right now. And I sense that transformation taking place more so now than ever.
All right, yeah, completely agree with you. I would say if I had to sum it up, this UAP thing is progressively evolving our culture, our belief systems, our DNA, maybe directly and indirectly, I don't know. I'd say it's manipulating and teaching us to transcend these false limitations of the human mind, the erosion of ego. If we're in communion with these intelligences or a grand super intelligence, it's communicating with us symbolically and psychically. And we talked about the Jungian aspects on that. I would pick up a point that Jacques Vallée made in some of his earlier work about the spiritual system, and that, you know, what we're experiencing, and again, we're talking about a non-human intelligence, this stuff is codependent. It's co-created. We're co-manifesting this. And we're within this hierarchical system of order. And maybe that implies duties that we may not even be aware of within a spiritual system that has a very practical application. I'd say that, you know, it does not exclude us as humans maybe coming from another timeline. Who knows? Maybe there is a time travel or time manipulation aspect to this. We're coming out of space and time. We're talking about dimensions, which are meant to be theoretical at this point. And we don't even need infinite or vast numbers of dimensions to vehicle the ideas that are behind UAP, or even from our perspective, if we were talking earlier about the science of the soul, you know, we're doing just that here and now in these very practical issues that we're dealing and facing on a day-to-day basis, from, you know, getting out of bed, looking after yourself, looking after other people, living honestly, living with integrity and a sense of morality, and emulating this higher sense of intelligence that does, I think, work through us and is probably within this non-human intelligence itself in certain areas. I don't think it's all love and light, as they say, at all, but I do believe in the fact that we're within this dualistic reality, and that there is there is a side for what we call good and evil. And often the evil is just the shadow within ourselves. And maybe that is also projecting back. So, you know, we want to know what the meaning of all this stuff is, not just the technicalities of what these objects are and who or what this or these non-human intelligence or intelligences are. And I would argue that the whole thing, everything, the material, it's just an expression of something that is entirely spiritual. And so we have to start to turn within. We have to turn towards the intelligence of the heart over the intellectual mind often. I think that the why as to why we're experiencing this now and have done for a very long time is to remind us that we're not really separate or inferior or superior, of course, to anything or anyone in our true essence or state, if there is this science of the soul that's happening without our knowledge for many. And, you know, evolution is relative. And perhaps all these beings and us, if there are beings, all have their place, and that we're just performing, like Shakespeare said, you know, every man has their, that we're just actors and we just have this kind of role to play in life. So, you know, maybe all of us, non-human and human, are part of a system of service where we're growing ourselves. Maybe we are growing one another, the non-human and the human, through a system of governance. And there's an entanglement. And there is a disparity of what we consider amoral and moral or morality between the two, especially when we get into the kind of more difficult sides, like abductions and mutilations, all this kind of weird stuff. But perhaps it is just part of a system of a higher order. And, you know, there really is no notion of good or bad, and that we're just interpreting it correctly. You know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. So it's a progression. And we are in this duality. There's a thesis and an antithesis. And what we're trying, what we should try to get to, is this synthesis, the ternary. And I think that what we're seeing happening now is this bursting of the personal bubble of experience or existence. And, you know, it's starting to wake us up to this joy of being able to understand self-knowledge and growth personally and as a collective, as a human society. And there's a very practical component to that. And I think that's my final word.
Well, I think that's a very good place to wrap this up, my brother. This has been a fantastic conversation. I mean, I love talking to you. Like, you know, when I first met you in Egypt, I mean, obviously we were talking before then, but actually hanging out with you and getting to know you better really made me realize that you've got a very unique personality and perspective on life. Obviously, you're extremely professionally driven. You know, you're extremely successful in your chosen field, but you're very sensitive. You're very empathic. You're very open to these types of conversations, which is why it's such a joy to conversate with you on these types of issues, because it's not just nuts and bolts. There is this esoteric perspective. It is necessary to bring these two things together. And I feel like we've done a good job of trying to articulate that during this talk. So thank you so much, JP, because it's just been awesome to talk with you on this.
Likewise, Jay. And for those watching, actually, we forgot to mention this. When we were at the step pyramid of Djoser at Saqqara, I had an esoteric experience. And within 30 minutes of that experience, Jay and I and others saw flashbulb UFOs, yep, or a UFO appearing, yep, in over the pyramid. In it was literally midday, and it was unmistakable. And that was a really special moment. It was almost like a, I don't know, an affirmation, a confirmation, or a recognition of some kind. It was amazing.
It really was amazing. And that whole trip was amazing. And in fact, would you like to just quickly tell people what you're up to? Because you brushed over it, but for anyone interested, you are doing a tour through Egypt soon. So do you want to let people know?
Yes, I will. I'm organizing a tour to Egypt in December. I believe it's from the 5th of December for 12 days. And I'm, you know, privileged to be joined by two dear friends, genuine friends, Ross Coulthart, the investigative journalist who you would have seen interviewing the likes of Dave Grush. He's the author of In Plain Sight. He's done many other things. And Nick Cook, who famously authored The Hunt for Zero Point. He's now much more oriented towards the consciousness sphere. He's a director of the Bigelow Institute of Consciousness Studies, and he's a great guy. And we're all very inquisitive and curious people. We're always learning. And, you know, we decided we wanted to do this trip together. We're going to have amazing private access to the Great Pyramid at night. We're going to be entering the Sphinx enclosure, which the general public can't do. We're going to go underneath the step pyramid of Djoser or Djoser, which Jay and I visited, and we saw this this flashbulb UFO occurring, and much more. And the accommodation is excellent. And it's just a great time of year to go because it's a lot cooler. So you can kind of do more on the feet. There's less tourists there. The quality of the light is really good, and you don't feel exhausted afterwards. So, you know, we're going to be doing a lot of stuff. And something unusual always happens on tour to Egypt. There's always something surprising. If you go there with an open mind, sincerity, and openness to the mystery of life and the mystery of Egypt, you know, it sounds kind of like marketing, but it's genuine. This weird stuff happens, and it's a privilege. So yeah, thanks a lot, Jay. Thank you.
You're welcome. And links will be in the description box below. So for anyone who wants to sign up, I would definitely recommend it. I mean, who wouldn't want to go through Egypt with people like JP, Ross Coulthart, Nick Cook? I'm going to try and get myself over there as well, because it was just such an amazing experience to be out there with JP and Johnny Enoch and Timothy Hogan, and many others when I first went. And real quick, actually, just because I think this is important to touch on, as you said, it's not just a marketing scheme. No, really, there are some strange things that occur. And I went out there, you know, as all of you know, I'm very open-minded. I've had consciousness experiences involving the phenomenon, so I'm certainly not a skeptic. But I do find myself sometimes a little bit skeptical of people that, you know, going to these temples and saying, oh, I'm feeling the vibe and the frequency. And I sometimes roll my eyes. I can't help myself. It's just the way I am. But we did go to a place. Was it Dendara with the Sekhmet? With the statue of Sekhmet?
That was at Karnak Temple.
Karnak.
Sekhmet Chapel, which is again somewhere that the public can't access. No, which we will be visiting, and it's just this beautifully preserved statue of the lioness Egyptian deity goddess Sekhmet, who is the kind of the element of aggression and war and protection. And she's perfectly preserved. And there is just this perfectly positioned hole in the ceiling, which allows this amazing sheet of light to kind of illuminate the statue. And you see the kind of dust particles floating. And
I mean, it's really very Indiana Jones type of experience. But I like, dude, the reason I brought it up is because, you know, at this point we've been visiting quite a few places, and a lot of people were saying they were getting feelings, and I'll be honest, I wasn't. I was loving it. I was having an amazing time, but I hadn't been getting these kind of you know, immediate rushes of feelings or you know, getting the resonance of the area. I was just enjoying myself. But going into that room was a weird one for me. As you know, I was walking around everywhere with my camera. I was filming like the whole experience, all the temples, everywhere we're going. I was filming the entire thing.
You did a great job. You really made the most of it. You know, fair play to you. You were fantastic. You were so kind to the other guests, and everybody got on. There was just a very nice vibe amongst the whole group. Everybody had a nice time and got on. There was you know, maybe that's why this experience happened, because there was this harmony amongst the group.
It really felt that way. It really felt that way.
Yeah.
It was like a little family. It was, yeah. We'd have made
honestly,
like...
I've been to like 52 countries. There's a lot more to see in the world. I've been to Peru. I've been to amazing places. But honestly, there is nothing or nowhere like Egypt on the face of this earth.
No.
It is the signature of something unbelievable that happened before known recorded history.
Yeah.
It does involve the transcendence of consciousness, which is the title of our tour. It involves the harmony and the integration of science, spirituality, aesthetics, and art, everything. There was just this sense, there's a sense of integration and oneness or unity. And the tradition and the technology that was not seen as, you know, superior to everything else that was going on has just been lost over time. There seems to have been a transmission that occurred, and then it just petered off.
Yeah, and no, I completely agree. And just to finish up this story, I was filming everything. We went to this temple in Karnak. We were told that we were going to get access to this room with this statue of Sekhmet. So I'm going in, and these, you know, like these big wooden doors, they open up, and you kind of go down this corridor. So I was filming. I was walking down the corridor filming. You come round the corner into this room, and as JP said, you've just got this solitude light beam coming from a single point in the roof, where this beam of light is illuminating this statue of Sekhmet in a very simple room. So it's just this, you know, very imposing image of Sekhmet that you come to. And I come around the corner, I'm filming, I immediately see the statue, and my camera just, I just, my arm just dropped down. My arm just dropped down to my side, and I was locked into staring at this statue, to the point where it actually felt like some form of gravity well. Like it was, I could feel myself getting pulled visually and almost physically towards this statue, and I was staring at this thing just without blinking, feeling completely locked in to a level that actually felt energetic to a certain degree that I can't truly articulate, but there was this weird energetic lock that I couldn't break away from. And I remember, you know, I don't know how much time had passed, but suddenly Johnny Enoch goes, "Hey man, let's go." And I was like, "Whoa!" I was shook out of it. I was completely hypnotized by it. And so if you get to go on this trip and you experience this room, I would love to hear comments, you know, drop a comment below. Tell me if you had that kind of experience, because I'm certainly not alone. There's been, I looked it up afterwards, and there's so many people that say that this is a very profound and weirdly energetically resonant statue, and it is extremely imposing as you go into this room. It's the only thing in this room, and this light beam is illuminating it. So it's a profound experience. The entirety of the Egypt trip for me was actually very transformative. You know, I was having a bit of a difficult time in my personal life prior to going to Egypt, and funnily enough, just for my own synchronicity's sake, because I'd been going through a bit of a difficult time with some friendships and personal relations, I felt the need for like a change, and I got this tattoo as a symbol of that, which is a staff of Hermes and a symbol of transformation. And this is a Greco-Egyptian version of the staff. I got that, and then 3 weeks later, this man right here invites me to Egypt.